our studies in the Sermon on the Mount, we read in chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel and from the first verse. Matthew chapter 7, pardon me, reading from verse 1. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, the door will be opened. Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Amen, and may God seal his word to our hearts. Can we, chapter 11 that we read together earlier, and the theme of this particular chapter develops the idea of the judgment of God and how that judgment should impact upon the way in which we daily live our lives. And as we read through this particular chapter, we will, I hope, see the importance of holding together two aspects of God's character. Seeing on the one hand God himself as judge of all men, and secondly, see God as the father of his redeemed children. God is both Father and judge. And the terrible thing for the unbeliever is that God is both. In rejecting God's judgment on his life, the unbeliever also rejects the privilege of having him as his father. And in rejecting God's fatherly grace, the unbeliever encounters God as judge, and only as judge. For the believer, the knowledge that God is Father transforms his view of God as judge. And the knowledge that God is his or her judge fills them with awe that such a God should also be their father. And in the verses, pardon me, in the verses before us this evening, we will, I hope, see how the knowledge of God as judge impacts upon the life of the Christian in relation to himself, to others, and to God. You will notice that in verse 1 Jesus says, "Judge not that you will not be judged." These are probably the most frequently used and least understood words from Matthew chapter 7. And an amazing variety of interpretations have been placed on these words. Tolstoy, for example, believed that Jesus was rejecting the whole idea of human law courts and the legal system. The whole judicial process was going down the drain as far as Tolstoy's interpretation of Jesus' teaching here was concerned. But you'll notice that the context has nothing at all to do with law courts, and instead focuses upon our individual dealings with one another. Some are sure that here Jesus is suggesting that we should conduct a funeral service on all of our critical faculties so that we develop that amazing ability to turn a blind eye to the faults of others and refuse to distinguish in them the difference between good and evil behavior. But to pretend that evil is good or doesn't matter is sheer hypocrisy. And that is not something that Jesus would advocate. Indeed, the very fact that God has made man in his image involves man in the ability to make valued judgments, to distinguish between what is good and what is evil. And both the preceding and the subsequent verses are based on the assumption that we should and will use the critical powers that God has given us. Jesus, for example, calls the Christian to be different from the world around him, the earlier part of his teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. How can he do that without using his critical faculties in order to evaluate the performance of the world and say, no, that behavior belongs to the world. I refuse to identify with that. That is clearly opposed to God and his rule. I won't have that in my life. And on the basis of this evaluation, he is to tailor his behavior, refusing to be conformed to this world and its standards, and allowing God instead to fashion his behavior. So when Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged," he is not suggesting that we conduct a funeral service on our critical faculties. The follower of Jesus is to be a critic in the sense of using his powers of discernment. However, he is not to be a judge in the sense of passing final and ultimate judgment on any individual. For this involves a claim to have both competence and authority to sit in judgment over them. And we are being reminded here by Jesus that men are ultimately answerable to God their Lord and not to their fellows. Let me turn your attention to Romans chapter 14 and reading in the fourth verse. Paul here says, "Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand." Then over a few pages in your New Testament to 1 Corinthians chapter 4, reading in verses 4 to 5, where Paul says, "My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. At that time, each will receive his praise from God." Now, from these passages, the point, I think, is quite clear that we dare not try or attempt to put ourselves in the place of God. We don't possess all the facts that make us competent, final judges. We can't read men's hearts, can we? We can't assess the motives behind their conduct. Let me try and illustrate this for just a moment. We may see a fellow Christian who has fallen into some terrible sin, and our immediate reaction might well be to raise our hands in horror and say, "Isn't that a disgrace? What a terrible testimony they bear to the name of Christ." But what we don't know is the number of occasions in which that particular individual has successfully resisted temptation towards that particular sin and triumphed over temptation. And we don't know the cost to them of doing that. So that the great concern of Jesus is that we guard against being censorious and attempt to arrogantly anticipate ourselves the day of judgment. For that is to usurp the authority of God. The censorious critic invariably judges harshly, for he does so without all of the facts at his fingertips. And there is a tendency to become a fault finder who is both negative and destructive in their criticism of others. There is a tendency to put the worst possible construction on the motives of others and be ungenerous towards their failures. So when Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged," he is certainly indicating that we should not engage in any form of final judgment and usurp the place of God. The command, "Do not judge," is therefore not a command to be blind towards the evil in others, but to be generous towards the sinner. Jesus does not ask us to cease to be men by suspending our critical faculties, but he commands us not to play at being God by setting ourselves up as those who will make a final judgment on others. When Jesus says, "Do not judge, that you will not be judged," he is saying, in the same way that you judge others, you will be judged. You will, says Jesus, be judged with the same measure you use, for it will be measured to you. What does he mean by that? This is obviously intended to be a check upon our critical faculties. But what does Jesus mean by that? What he is not saying is this. He is not saying that God will use the same vindictive principles that we sometimes use in our judgment of others, but that the judgment of God will be based on our lives and how our hearts have expressed themselves in thought and in action towards others. I think it is so important that we grasp that. You will notice in verses 3 and 4 that Jesus recites a famous little parable, the point of which is to expose the hypocrisy in which we can so easily engage when we criticize others. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, "Let me take the speck out of your eye," when all the time you have a plank in your own eye? Simply put, we love to meddle in the little faults in the lives of others while refusing to deal with the serious faults in our own lives. Here is a further reason. The humor of Jesus is quite devastating at this point. If you have ever tried to remove a foreign obstacle from someone's eye, then you will know that it is an extremely delicate operation. Consult Dr. Wiley at the close of this service. You need good sight. You need a steady hand. But most importantly, you need an unimpeded view of the eye to be operated on. The last thing in all the world that you possibly need is a large log that is stuck in your own eye. You see the remarkable humor of Jesus here as he paints this picture of the man with the big log saying, "Don't worry, I'll get the speck out. I'm just the person you need to remove that speck from your eye. I'll get it." Can you think of anything more guaranteed than to make the patient lose confidence? The doctor says, "Sit down, you've got a sore eye, I'll attend to it." And they approach you with this enormous log stuck in their eye, and you think, "Help, send for another doctor, I don't want him or I don't want her." Now, when this caricature is transferred to ourselves, and to our ridiculous fault-finding, we don't always appreciate the joke, do we? For in the dregs of our fallen natures, there lurks the fatal tendency to exaggerate the faults of others and to minimize our own. when we compare ourselves with others, we find it, do we not, difficult to be objective and impartial. And as I was saying this morning, if the truth be told, the very things that we find most objectionable in other people, the very things that we want to point the accusing finger at and criticize, are often the very things that lurk in our own hearts and which we have failed to deal with. Now, the truly repulsive element in the critical behavior in view here is that it presents itself, you will notice, in the guise of well-intentioned kindness. Can I help you with this little speck in your life? The hypocrisy of this self-inflated behavior Jesus finds quite nauseating. To exalt ourselves by disparaging others is a very cheap way of seeking to gain some kind of moral superiority over them. Lord, I thank you that I'm not as other men, said the Pharisee in the temple, and not certainly not like this publican in the corner. Big log, little speck. Criticizing in an attempt to boost our own moral superiority. In our dealings with others, the very least we should be doing is to apply to ourselves the same strict standard that we apply to others. We find Paul reminding the Corinthians of this, and the Corinthian church were great at finding fault. They were experts. They had PhDs in fault finding. If anyone had any problems, you could be sure that the Corinthians would track it down. They were bloodhounds, par excellence. And Paul writes to this church, and he says, but if we judged ourselves, we would not come under judgment. This is what you've failed to do, he said to the Corinthian church, to the fault-finding, to the critical church. If we judged ourselves, that's what you've failed to do, we would not come under judgment. Here then is a second reason why we are unfit to be judges. Not simply because we are fallible human beings who do not possess all of the facts, but because we are fallen human beings who view things with a distorted perspective. Now, in the light of this, you may well be thinking that it is safer not to become involved with other Christians at all. That it's really best to opt out of other people's lives. And some people have taken Jesus' meaning here to be that he is telling us all to mind our own business. Don't poke your nose in anybody else's business. Don't be concerned about how anybody else lives their lives. Just be concerned with yourselves. That other people's feelings are no concern of ours whatsoever. But that's a very dangerous conclusion to draw. Censoriousness and hypocrisy are forbidden, but this does not relieve us from our brotherly responsibility to one another. This would run contrary to the whole teaching of Jesus. Later on in this same gospel, in Matthew 18, in verse 15, Jesus will say, if your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault. Just between the two of you. And if he listens to you, you have won your brother over. Jesus doesn't say, if your brother sins against you, then mind your own business and don't say anything to him. Let him continue merrily in his own way. Go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. And if he listens to you, you have won your brother over. Jesus goes on to unpack a whole line of teaching on the subject of church discipline, but we won't go into that this evening. Once we have seen the necessity of dealing with our own eye trouble and known the relief that that brings, and anyone who has ever had something in their eye, an irritant, will tell you of the euphoria of relief that has been theirs when it's gone. It's marvelous. Not to have that awful irritant there anymore. It's great. It's wonderful. Once we have known the relief which the removal of the irritant can bring, we will not only see clearly to deal with our brother's eyes, but we'll want to do so with tenderness and care. Why? Knowing God's grace and mercy and forgiveness and relief ourselves, we will want others to experience that too. We find this idea developed by Paul in his epistle to the Galatians in chapter 6 and verse 1 following. He says, "Brothers, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. But watch yourself, or you may also be tempted. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ." Now, we often quote the text, don't we? Carry one another's burdens. But the immediate context of that teaching is this. If someone is caught out in a sin, those of you who are spiritual should restore him gently. That's part and parcel of carrying their burden, of being involved with them in their difficulty. And the word that is translated restore here in this passage was used in antiquity for setting a broken bone. Therefore, we are to address the faults of others with care and gentleness and kindness. And you will notice that this caring approach stands in stark contradiction to the harsh, censorious, superior spirit that Jesus is dealing with here, and sadly to which Christians are often exposed when confronted by their fellows. We are to deal with others as fellow patients who have ourselves undergone the corrective soul surgery of Christ, and we know the pain involved in that. And we will surely want in that context to offer the maximum comfort and support. I've heard people say something like this, Christian people, "I care for my friends too much to talk to them about their failure." But what they describe as care is often cowardice, bordering upon indifference. A speck of dirt in the eye is rightly called a foreign body. It doesn't belong. It is alien, unusually painful, and often dangerous. Leave it there, offering no attempt to remove it. And that is surely inconsistent with brotherly love. Now again, it is clear that Jesus is not condemning criticism as such, but only criticism of others when we have exercised or failed to exercise comparable self-criticism. Jesus is not opposed to correction, but only the correction of those who have themselves refused to be patient and to submit themselves to the surgeon's knife. Recently, I mentioned John Chrysostom to you, a noted preacher in the early church, and we find him writing on this subject, and he says this: correct him, but not as a foe, not as an adversary exacting a penalty, but as a physician providing medicine. As a physician providing medicine. And that is clearly in line with the teaching of Jesus. He's not saying you should never correct anyone else in the church. We have a responsibility so to do. But he is saying, be very careful of the way in which you seek to do that, and ensure that you yourself have placed yourself on the surgeon's table and allowed God to do all of the corrective surgery that he wants to do in your own life. Now, when we come to verse 6, and to the matter of casting one's pearls before swine, we might ask ourselves, does this really belong to this block of teaching on the subject of judgment? Well, yes, it clearly does. For it impresses upon the Christian the need of discrimination. That's the word here, discrimination. Not everyone is grateful for corrective criticism. In the book of Proverbs, one of the ways in which the writer distinguishes between the wise man and the fool is that he tells us the fool despises correction. Proverbs 9 and 8, do not rebuke a mocker, or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. Now in verse 6, Jesus, pardon me, uses very strong language to describe a particular kind of man or woman. He is saying that spiritually, some people behave like dogs and pigs. And we need to recognize that and behave appropriately. And there are a number of possible applications here. First of all, we are not being called to mindless evangelism. There are some people who trample upon the message of the gospel, refusing constantly to recognize its value. And they do that in the way that a pig would trample on a pearl, refusing to recognize the value of the pearl. Now, Jesus is not forbidding the preaching of the gospel to unbelievers, but describing those who have had ample opportunity to hear and receive the good news and who have decisively and defiantly rejected it. They provide clear evidence by their behavior for their contempt of God and his gospel. And to persist beyond a certain point in offering the gospel to such individuals is to invite not only rejection with contempt, but with blasphemy. You may remember the way in which Jesus practically applied this principle to the ministry of the 12 before he sent them out on their first evangelistic mission. In Matthew 10 and verse 14, Jesus said, "If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your word, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town." We need to be able to discriminate and make judgments. There is also a more general principle underlying Jesus' words in verse 6, and that is learning the wisdom of appropriate activity. Why don't we feed swine with pearls? Because it's inappropriate to do so. The person who does so neither understands the value of pearls nor the nature of pigs. Yet we often find believers engaged in activities or behaving in a fashion that is inappropriate to their Christian profession. It is searching to ask, how appropriate is my behavior? Do I, by my life, enhance or obscure the gospel? And we are called upon to judge ourselves in this matter. Now, running on very quickly, we ask, why does Jesus, in verse 7, return to the subject of prayer? He has already dealt with prayer fairly comprehensively earlier on in the Sermon on the Mount. Why now, in verses 7 to 11, does he return to the subject of prayer? Let me suggest that it is impossible to be exposed to all of Jesus' teaching here on judgment and right and wise discernment and not to be aware of our own need. We're often so spiritually short-sighted and undiscerning, are we not? And Jesus teaches here what has been described as beggar's logic. We are to persist daily in asking for God's grace as beggars daily pound upon doors and say, "Will you give us something to eat? We're hungry. Will you give us something to eat?" We are to persist in this way, pursuing the provision of God's grace. In our case, however, the one who responds to our asking and the one who reveals himself to our seeking and the one who opens his heart to our knocking is none other than a Father to us. And that fact should quicken our expectation and confidence. We must never lose sight of the fact that the one who is our judge is also our Father, so that to live under the judgment of God for the Christian does not produce in him a paralyzing fear. Incidentally, it is, in fact, a remedy for self-absorption and the way to real spiritual freedom, in which we are happy to serve God and others, to recognize that the God into whose presence we come the God to whom we are answerable and accountable is also our own heavenly Father. And this leads on to verse 12. Only the person who sees at one and the same time that he is a beggar and a son can confidently access the grace of God. Only such a person will be sufficiently set free from self-centeredness to put others first and to do to them what he would appreciate receiving from them. And this principle gives us, in a nutshell, what is expounded and illustrated endlessly in Scripture. The gospel does not enforce a complex set of rules upon us, but it does call us into a relationship of grace and love. It's recognizing that. It's seeing that. It's being overwhelmed by that, being mastered by that, that frees us to serve others and to bring blessing to them as God has brought it to us. Knowing God as judge has a sanctifying effect upon our lives. It encourages a more rigorous pursuit of holiness. It teaches us to be stricter with ourselves than with others, and creates a determination to master all that is wrong in our lives. But knowing that God is judge should also teach us to be merciful and gentle in our dealings with others. For it is as we see the exposed weaknesses in our own hearts and the failures in our own lives that we are equipped to be compassionate with and tender towards others in their failure. To see God as judge will also clarify our attitude towards the Lord himself. And this will influence our Christian service and create a new sense of urgency in our prayer lives, so that we will be asking and seeking and knocking, "Oh God, help me. As one who is accountable to you, help me in my relationships with others. Help me to care responsibly and kindly, and not censoriously and judgmentally. Help me to be supportive towards my brother in his need." And we make that request not simply to one who is the judge of all the earth, but to one who has revealed himself to be a caring Heavenly Father who delights to hear and to respond to that kind of petition. May God seal his word to all our hearts.